Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. And welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Pamela Arsenault of the Historic New Orleans Collection, whose new book is Guidebooks to Sin, The Blue Books of Storyville, New Orleans. We'll also hear from Susan Rivers, whose debut novel is The Second Mrs. Hockaday. It's a great pleasure to welcome Pamela Arsenault to The Reading Life. Pamela is the senior librarian and rare books curator at the Historic New Orleans Collection, where she's worked since 1981. Today, we're celebrating her first book, and it's a fascinating one, Guidebooks to Sin, The Blue Books of Storyville, New Orleans. Pamela Arsenault, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, it's so great because so many scholars acknowledge you as this great help to them and their work. And here's your work. And it is so interesting. So tell us a little bit about the Guidebooks to Sin, the Blue Books of Storyville, and how you first encountered them and got to know so much about them.
Well, you mentioned that so many scholars have cited my work. I first wrote an article called Guidebooks to Sin that was published in the Journal of Louisiana History back in 1987. And so many scholars have cited that article, but in the years intervening, I discovered a lot of errors in my own article, largely because a lot of the sources I used at the time were also full of errors. So all of these years, I've been sort of gathering more information, with in the back of my mind perhaps writing a book, but not really. Most of my career, I've been a reference librarian. When I was first interviewed for the position at the Historic New Orleans Collection, the few books I had read, among them was the Al Rose, Storyville, New Orleans.
The classic.
And he has a chapter called The Press of Storyville, and he talks about the Mascot and the Sunday Sun, both newspapers of the time that reported on the red light scene and the underworld. And in that chapter was also a bit about the Blue Books, these little directories to the brothels and directories of women who worked in the district. And I was fascinated by New Orleans, of course, and by that period in New Orleans. And being a librarian, here's the bibliographical aspect of Storyville. And of course, I was drawn to that. When I was hired at the Historic New Orleans Collection, I discovered that our library had a significant number of these little guidebooks. So there they were, and I could play with them.
So, now, describe them. Describe what they look like for people.
Most of them are very small. They fit within the palm of the hand, usually an average about 100 pages. They're filled with all kinds of advertisements for services of interest to men. Champagne, wine, beer, liquor, cigars, taxi services, venereal disease cures,
right,
piano tuners, mirror, glass, and crockery supplies.
Uh-huh.
You know, Lubat. I don't know if many
the
people remember.
The kitchen equipment store, yes.
Lubat advertised in the Blue Books.
And we know who wrote many of them, don't we?
We know who compiled
many of them,
perhaps not written. None of these little guidebooks give you what librarians like to think of as bibliographic notation.
Uh-huh.
There's usually no title page with the compiler or editor noted. There's no date for most of them. You have to deduce what the date is. Two of them do have an edition and a date marked on them. But for the most part, they give you little information about who put these together. We have a clue in most of the introductions that advise readers to use this book to steer proper, particularly during the carnival It seems that the blue books were issued about once a year in anticipation of extra visitors coming in for carnival season. But the name that you see at the bottom of the preface is Billy News, N-E-W-S. Billy News seems to be a pseudonym for Tom Anderson's right-hand man, Billy Struve. Tom Anderson was the so-called mayor of Storyville and had a lot of interest in properties in the district. And Billy Struve had been a police reporter for the Item and had a lot of connections in the local underworld. And he wound up managing most of Tom Anderson's interests, both in the district and outside the district as well. So it seems that Billy News is actually the compiler of these little blue books.
Did all of them contain that prohibition against mailing these guidebooks?
Almost all of them did, because they were considered obscene material according to the 1873 Comstock Law, which prohibited the transmission of rude or salacious material through the U.S. mails. So, yeah, there was that factor. A couple of them, the earliest one, I think, does not have that included. And by the way, we're talking about blue books collectively. Because I talk about in the book, there is a large number of these guides that were issued under the title Blue Book. There were also what I like to refer to as alternative Storyville era guides. And these include even smaller little pamphlets like The Hello and The Lid and The Scout. There is also something called the Tenderloin Guide to the District of New Orleans, and there is a rival publication called The Red Book.
Right.
And it's quite a lovely item. It has numerous printer's embellishments and almost none of the grammatical horrors or misinformation that you find in the majority of the blue books.
Now, it's so fascinating that we are fascinated by these guidebooks to a place that no longer exists, that only existed for 20 years, you know?
Well, they marketed an image.
Yes, that has lasted and lasted.
And they've added to that kind of aura of New Orleans being a good time town, that risque, naughty kind of reputation that the city has. The blue books sell the sizzle, not the steak. The ads have almost nothing of real description about the women. The madam's ads in the blue books are very interchangeable from one edition to the next. Phrases are repeated from one woman's ad to the next woman's ad. A queen among queens. Women are princesses, are all of a like type, and they're always clever entertainers and refined ladies. And we're talking about brothel inhabitants,
right, exactly.
And prostitutes. And the refined people refer to the Bradford when speaking of a place to go. The refined people usually didn't speak very much about going to brothels in Storyville. They certainly not in mixed company.
Now, I know in the book you say that the Historic New Orleans collection has 24 copies of the Blue Book representing 15 different editions. So how would you classify these? Would you say that they are among the rarest of New Orleans books?
I would say they are. We have 24 of the genuine Storyville era guides, which includes the ones not called Blue Books. I would say they are largely because of attrition. Because of the nature of these books, often the men themselves who bought them as souvenirs would perhaps throw them away or discard them before loved ones came upon them.
Right.
Conversely, once the gentleman died, if he hadn't thrown it away, and say a loved one is going through his effects and they find one of these things, are embarrassed and don't want his sterling reputation tarnished.
So the ones that we do have at the collection have come to us primarily from four major collectors.
General Williams, the Historic New Orleans Collection's founder, had already had agents through the Goodspeed's bookshop in Boston acting for him in building up the collections of what would become the Historic New Orleans Collection. So Goodspeeds was instructed to go for the lot that had 12 blue books. When he acquired them, he was very happy to have been the winning bidder on this lot because they are considered rare and they are very difficult to find when they do come up on the market.
Well, one of the things that is so great about your book is that it's fascinating on so many levels. I mean, if you love New Orleans history, you get this insight into Storyville. If you love books, this is a story of such a literary oddity, you know, such a unique, curious little book. And then if you have a slightly prurient side, and who doesn't? you want to know what's in these blue books, you know? So it's endlessly fascinating.
They are fascinating. And it's interesting to me, too. They were banned by the Comstock law to be sent through the mails. But if you read the ads, they're very tame by today's standards.
Oh, yes.
They're very mild. There is almost no reference to sex, with the exception of fellatio in 69, or French, as they're called in the books. But there's almost nothing to indicate that these brothels are anything other than refined and interesting places to visit, decorated in the height of style with elegant ladies who are entertainers and will make the busy working man lose his sorrows and troubles, and a good time will be had by all.
Right?
A visit will teach more than pen can describe.
Now, there's one quotation that appears after a certain point in all of these blue books, and you use it as an opening quotation in your book. And I wonder if you talk about where that came from and what that means.
The old French phrase, on y soit qui mal y pense, or shame to him who thinks evil of it. Many people may be familiar with it as the phrase that is associated with the Order of the Garter, which goes back to British royalty back in the 14th century, perhaps. But about 1905, Blue Books started putting this line in, on y soit qui mal y pense. Perhaps as a response to the rising tide of progressivism that sought not to just contain prostitution to an area out of sight, out of mind, perhaps, but to eradicate it altogether. So it's sort of evil to him who evil thinks, or shame on him who thinks evil of it. We're just having a good time.
That's right.
And that's something else about the Blue Books. They are consistently promising a good time. Everything is shiny and bright and wonderful and the best that money can procure, which is a far cry from what the reality of the district was.
Of course.
It was still a vice district. Fights happened there, murders, crime of all sorts. The reality wasn't rosy.
Right.
The picture that the Blue Books tried to portray was this wonderful entertainment venue where a good time could be had by all. But we can't forget that it was still a hard life for the women who worked there, most of whom are not described accurately. Many of the women listed in the directory section probably are working under assumed names.
And we know the names of many of the famous madams, but not of their employees. Yes.
Right.
Well, it's an amazing book. And this is perfectly timed because this is the 100th anniversary of the closure of Storyville. So perfect. We've been talking with Pamela Arsenault, whose new book is Guidebooks to Sin, the Blue Books of Storyville, New Orleans. You can meet her at several amazing events that are coming right up. The Historic New Orleans Collection hosts a day-long symposium on Storyville, February 4th at the Hotel Montleon, and the night before, February 3rd, Pamela will be lecturing on the book at 5:30 at the Queen Anne Ballroom at the hotel, then signing books at a reception at the Historic New Orleans Collection, 533 Royal Street. Then she'll be at Octavia Books Tuesday, February 7th at 6, then Maple Street Bookshop Thursday, February 9th at 6, and Storyville will be the theme of the opening night gala at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, March 22nd. Check out hnoc.org and tennesseewilliams.net for complete information. Pamela, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. This has been fun.
One of the greatest pleasures in life is reading a terrific first novel, which makes it a special pleasure to welcome Susan Rivers to The Reading Life. This South Carolina writer is an award-winning playwright, and her first novel, The Second Mrs. Hockaday, is an amazing historical page-turner. Susan Rivers, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
I'm so glad to be with you this morning.
Now, we may think modern relationships are complicated, but you've shown us that during the Civil War, things were pretty tough when it came to keeping a family together. So tell us a bit about Placidia Hockaday and her fierce spirit of survival.
Well, she is really thrown into it from the beginning of her marriage. And this is really what fascinates, I think, anybody who reads historical documents, who visits historical sites. You think, how did those men and women and children survive what they did? How did they endure what they did? And then even manage to thrive, you know, having 7, 8, 9 children in conditions that we would just collapse if we encountered in modern-day society. So people say, well, we are not as tough as people were then, but I don't know if that's the case. I wonder if extreme challenges just bring out the strength in human beings, as it does with Placidia. So she encounters difficulties from the very beginning of this sort of hasty marriage that she jumps into with Major Griffith Hockaday. He's called back sooner than they'd expected to the front, to the Army of Northern Virginia, where his 13th South Carolina Regiment is posted with Lee. And she is left running a 300-acre farm, a number of servants, which is, of course, what white farm owners called their slaves. And she has also a young son to care for, her stepson, because his mother, Hockaday's first wife, died while he was away of typhoid fever. So she's left dealing with this in an environment that is fraught with risk and predators, really, because of the sort of the collapse of society in the South at the time. And certainly by the time Sherman has done his march to the sea through Georgia and then has decided he's also coming through South Carolina to teach them a lesson since he blames them for starting the Civil War, she really has to surmount almost insurmountable odds and situations. And I was interested in exploring how she did that, where she found the strength, and how she sort of reorganized her ideas about society, about what family means, about her relationship with African Americans, especially the ones who work on her farm, and with others as well, which I don't want to say too much or I'll give away some of the secrets in the novel.
Now, the plot hinges on a legal action that Major Hockaday brings against Placidia. And this is based on a real legal case, isn't it?
Yes. I read about a case that a grand jury in a rural county in Georgia brought. They indicted a young woman in 1865 who had conceived a child while her husband was away in a Georgia infantry regiment for 4 years. She conceived a child, and the child was born living, and then everybody in town believed that she had killed the child and buried it on the farm. When her husband came home, he forced her to show him where, in fact, the baby was buried on the farm. And he was so angry and so dismayed and distraught, disappointed, that he pushed to have her indicted by the grand jury in this county, and they did. And she went on trial.
Wow. One of the things I do love about this book is that it comes together from a variety of sources. I mean, it's written largely as an epistolary novel. And really, who doesn't love to read other people's letters, you know?
Right.
And in the form of diary entries and letters from Placidia herself and other letters from her cousin, her son, her stepson, depositions from the trial. Now, that must have been a lot of fun as a writer to tackle all those multiple points of view.
Yes. It was, and do you know, when I began it, one of the unusual things is that the novel came to me presenting itself as it wanted to be told. It just wanted to be told in portions of this fictional inquest that was conducted into the baby's death as part of a correspondence between Placidia once she's jailed and then she's out on bond and staying with a sympathetic doctor, to her cousin, Mildred, who's her close friend and confidant, as well as letters from Griffith to her And then the final sort of epistolary format are these diary entries that Placidia made on the blank backs of a copy of David Copperfield that was her father's. Since paper was at such a premium in the South during the Civil War, many things were because of the blockade. So she's writing these on the backs of David Copperfield, but her diary and the Dickens book does not come to light until the second generation begins digging into what happened in the form of her son, Achilles Hockaday, and he begins to uncover what his mother as well as his father went through, and it changes the course of his life as a result.
Well, it's so interesting because you come to fiction writing from playwriting.
Right.
It's a wonderful way to make us grow attached to so many characters.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. I think it was the dormant playwright in me who wanted to borrow some of that immediacy with the reader / audience member that I do miss from the theater, where you're putting words in actors' mouths and they're forming a relationship with an audience member that's alchemical because it's happening in real time. That's why a play is a different play every night, depending on who's in the audience and who's on the stage. So I think I wanted my major characters, their voices, to connect directly with the reader and for there to be a kind of experience that way that isn't quite as immediate with a conventional narrator.
Well, and if you love books as objects, for example, or
right.
things or paper, I mean, there's so much in this book about the need for writing paper, how rare it was. And I love Placidia's journal entries on the backs of those illustrations in David Copperfield, because you have the incredible pleasure of the picture captions as
right.
headings, which I adored. It made me smile the whole time I was reading along.
Well, it's strange, too, because I was just going through the list of the illustrations with each new diary entry, but sometimes the caption for the illustration matched what Placidia was writing in the diary to a sort of spooky echo. It was strange. That's what I mean about this book. It just had, some kind of supernatural power at work sometimes, I think, because there were a lot of things like that. The characters in this novel, for me, were so real. I mean, maybe super real, in the sense that they were with me all the time. I mean, I taught summer school when I was writing this, you know, the first draft of this novel, and I have very little memory of summer school. I know they all passed. But I do feel like everywhere I went and everything I did, they were beside me going through whatever they were going through. And in fact, when I was, you know, about 40, 50 pages into the novel, they began telling me what they were going to do. And I've talked with other writers who say that they have this experience, too, when they have a very close connection to what they're working on.
Yes, and it's almost always a sign that you're on the right track, I think.
I hope that's true.
Now, one of the things that I'd like to stress about this book, because it is one of the endearing parts of it, is that it is a great love story. It's really several love stories. And that must have been a special pleasure to write.
Yes, it is. I became so close to Placidia and Griffith, I really regretted having to put them through the difficulties that I did. Placidia especially, I really resisted that. You know, I sort of paused when I knew, you know, I was going to have to present her with some real hard challenges. Because I loved them too, but I had to. That was part of the trial by fire that they both go through. And I'm not sure if I could say that it deepens their love. It changes their love, certainly.
Right.
And they do find a way to salvage something. And I don't want to give away too much again by the end of the book, but they do find a way to, sort of like Adam and Eve after the fall, post-lapsarian, isn't that the word? Somebody who's an expert on that told me that's the word. But it's after the fall. They have to recreate. You know, if they're not going to be in paradise, then where are they going to be? They have to create it on their own. Maybe that's a better way to live and love together, because you don't have God telling you what to do all the time. It's something you've made on your own. You've endured on your own, and you can look back at that and say, we came through this.
Right.
I hope it is a powerful love story.
It is indeed. We've been talking with Susan Rivers, whose fine first novel is The Second Mrs. Hockaday. She's on book tour right now. We've actually been speaking with her while she's in the woods outside Faulkner's home of Roanoke. But you can meet her Wednesday, February 1st at 6 at Octavia Books. Susan, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was such a pleasure to spend time with you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Colleen Mooney hosts an organizational meeting for a New Orleans chapter of Sisters in Crime, a national organization that promotes the advancement, recognition, and professional development of women crime writers. Tuesday, January 31st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Susan Tucker discusses and signs City of Remembering, A History of Genealogy in New Orleans, Tuesday, January 31st at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Susan Rivers, reads from and signs The Second Mrs. Hockaday, Wednesday, February 1st at 6 at Octavia Books. LSU professor Dana Berkowitz signs Botox Nation, Changing the Face of America, Thursday, February 2nd at 6 at Octavia Books. John Kemp signs Expressions of Place, The Contemporary Louisiana Landscape, Thursday, February 2nd from 6 to 8 at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art. Room 220 presents a reading by poet Dr. Jerry Ward, whose new book is Fractal Song, and storyteller El Kasimu Harris, Thursday, February 2nd at 7 at Antenna Gallery on St. Claude Avenue. Dr. Raul Llanos discusses his book, The Art of Consciously Healing Our Addictions, Thursday, February 2nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Nathan Hugin of the National World War II Museum's Education Department discusses German POWs in Louisiana, Thursday, February 2nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Pamela Arsenault, discusses her new book, Guidebooks to Sin, The Blue Books of Storyville, New Orleans. That's at a lecture Friday, February 3rd at 5:30 at the Hotel Monteleon Queen Anne Ballroom, followed by a reception and signing at 6:30 at the Historic New Orleans Collection on Royal Street. She also appears Tuesday, February 7th at 6 at Octavia Books, then Maple Street Bookshop Thursday, February 9th at 6. And Storyville will be the theme of the opening night gala at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, March 22nd. Check out hnoc.org or tennesseewilliams.net for complete information. The Historic New Orleans Collection presents the 22nd Annual Williams Research Center Symposium, Storyville and Jazz, 1917. The all-day event takes place Saturday, February 4th at the Hotel Monteleon and features talks about Storyville and jazz by such well-known figures as Ted Widmer, Alicia Long, David Seger, John Lawrence, Jeff Rosenheim, Bruce Boyd Rayburn, Greg Lambusi, Rachel Lyons, Karen Armagost, Ron Rona, and Dr. Michael White. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.